It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It was several years ago when our guest today, psychiatrist Daniel Carlat, had his aha moment, realizing that he and his profession had gone astray. Dr. Carlat was conducting his first interview with a patient he calls JJ, a struggling salesman experiencing anxiety and distress. Carlat went through the usual list of questions with JJ and was able to deduce that his patient was suffering from generalized anxiety disorder. He then prescribed Zoloft as the drug to best combat JJ's diagnosis, telling him it would help lift his brain's serotonin levels. But as JJ left, he asked Carlat, "So, Dr. Freud, the causes are all in the brain? Isn't there some explanation in my childhood?" It was meant as a joke, but for Carlat it was no laughing matter, awakening in him a longtime nagging concern that psychiatry had lost its curiosity about why patients experience problems as it became enthralled with the biochemistry of mental illnesses and the ever-growing number of new drugs promising cure. In short, talk therapy was out, medications were in. Treating root problems was out, treating symptoms was in, and Carlat concludes it's all to the detriment of patients. Now in his new book, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, Carlat argues for a new approach, one that combines a more honest assessment of what drugs can and can't do with more respect for the traditional work of talking it out. Today in The Exchange, Dr. Daniel Carlat is with us on why he sees a crisis in psychiatry and the prescription he offers. Let's hear from you, too. If you've taken drugs for mental health issues like Prozac or Ritalin, did they work or not? Do you agree with Dr. Carlat that talk therapy should be more a part of treatment, or do you see it as a waste of time? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Daniel Carlat joins us on the line. And Dr. Carlat, really nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for inviting me. I love to talk about this stuff, Laura.
Well, how and when, Dr. Carlat, did we get on this track of a heavy-duty emphasis on drugs over talk therapy?
It's been a gradual process. I would say that if you had to choose a particular year, it might be 1988, which was the year that Prozac was introduced as a medication. Prozac is an antidepressant that obviously I think most listeners have heard about. There was a famous book, Listening to Prozac, by Peter Kramer, that was came out in 1992. But at any rate, Prozac was no more effective than the other antidepressants that it replaced, but it had the advantage of having very few side effects, and it was very, very easy for doctors to prescribe. So very quickly, Prozac became the best-selling psychiatric medication in history.
So describe the shift in your profession then, Dr. Carlat. So Prozac comes out, and all of a sudden doctors say, hey, this is kind of easy. I think I'll go with this instead of doing an hour of talk therapy.
Right, and it wasn't just the doctors that were saying that it was easy. It was the patients who were responding and saying, wow, I feel better. This is the first time a lot of patients took an antidepressant because the old ones were causing so much constipation and urinary retention, all kinds of problems. So many patients were also giving feedback that for the first time in my life, I'm not as irritable. I'm not yelling at the kids as much. I feel comfortable going into parties. I mean, there were a whole range of symptoms beyond depression, including anxiety and irritability, that people were now finding relief from. So as usual with most social events, there's no one explanation. It's kind of multifactorial.
Well, and another factor that you write about is that health insurers always want to get more patients in, more patients out, and that's contributed to a rise in pill usage.
Exactly. So that health insurance found that reimbursing psychiatrists to prescribe medications for brief 15 to 20-minute visits was a very cost-effective way of, at least quickly in the short term, getting patients better, getting them over their depression. But what we found over the last 20 or 30 years is that there are also therapy techniques that have been now compared in clinical trials with medications. And it turns out that while the medications are very effective in the short run, some of the therapy techniques are actually more effective longer term because they give patients the tools that they need, the psychological tools they need to fend off future episode of depression in response to stresses that might occur in their lives.
And you make the point again and again in the book that, you know, a more balanced approach would be good, and I definitely want to uncover that with you. A couple more things, though, just to lay out at the beginning, Dr. Carlett. You talk about how researchers, including yourself, got more interested in the chemical makeup of mental illness. You say partly out of a desire to remove some stigma. Can you explain?
Well, there was a the 1990s were the were called the decade of the brain, and there was a period during my training, and my training began at Mass General Hospital in psychiatry in 1992. So I was sort of, you know, right in the swing of that decade. We thought that we sort of were figuring it all out, that we had figured out that there was a chemical imbalance, that the imbalance had something to do with serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain, norepinephrine, which was another neurotransmitter in the brain. And if we were able to tell our patients that we figured out that you have a biological problem called depression that's really no different from diabetes, and the treatment Prozac is really no different from giving insulin, then we were hoping that we could really take away that stigma that people now feel where they think it's really their fault or that it's a moral failing of theirs. And we could say, no, it's not a moral failing. You just have a physical illness, just like any other physical illness. Don't worry about it.
And yet you call it a convenient myth. So that's not really true?
It may or may not be true, but at this point we are so far from knowing the truth about that we're looking at probably another century or two before we can truly say we understand the molecular biology of mental illness. And that's not for lack of trying. It's just a question of the fact that the brain is complicated, and there are 100 billion neurons. When you add all the synapses that each neuron makes with other neurons in the brain, we're talking about somewhere in the range of 100 trillion or a quadrillion active synapses that are happening right now, even as we're speaking, in each one of our brains. So, I mean, what's surprising is not that we haven't been able to figure this out. What's surprising to me is that we've been able to figure out anything about the brain whatsoever.
Wow, a century. We won't know for another century.
That's my prediction.
Wow.
It sounds discouraging, but on the other hand, it's a tough nut to crack.
So you probably can't answer this question, but I'll ask you anyway, Dr. Carlett. So how much do these drugs aimed at mental illness really help, and how much are they painting over an underlying problem?
Well, actually, Laura, that's the good news, which is that even though we don't really understand what's happening in the brain to mental illness, and even though we don't really understand how these medications work in the brain, somehow, by accident for the most part, and the history of psychiatry is filled with serendipity and these accidents of discovering things that happen to work that we wouldn't have predicted, but somehow we have figured out a small toolbox of medications that really do help quite a few people to a certain extent, with the proviso that we don't know if they work long-term, you know, over decades. And we don't know whether there are long-term side effects and whether it's whether it becomes very hard for people to ever get off of these medications.
Right. All right. I have a lot more questions for you, Dr. Carlett, but I also want to invite our listeners to join us. The number here on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Dr. Daniel Carlett. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine, also editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report, and author of the brand new book that we're talking about called Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. If you have some personal experience with some of the drugs that we're talking about for mental illness, give us a call. Tell us if they worked and what you think about Dr. Carlett's contention that we need a broader approach toward treating mental illness. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Dr. Carlett, in your book, you write about the golden generation of psychiatry in the 1950s when your father was practicing. What did that generation do right that we don't do now?
Well, that was the generation that was trained in the time when we were still doing Freudian psychoanalysis. You know, people probably have seen this mostly in New Yorker cartoons, where you have, you know, the bearded psychiatrist asking comical questions of a patient lying on a couch. That's old-fashioned, and at this point, it's very rare to have somebody go into a therapist's office, day after day after day and lying on a couch with a silent therapist, which was what that was. But in that time, that was the form of training that people got, because there really weren't any good medications, or if there were good medications, they caused so many side effects that most patients just didn't want to take them. But I'll say the one good thing about that golden generation is that at least they learned how to do the therapy. And not only did they go through their residency, the medical school and their residency, but after they left their residency, and here's the crucial point, they practiced and they practiced and they practiced and they talked to patient after patient after patient, and they learned what is the most crucial aspect of what I do on a day-to-day basis, which is psychology. And we call ourselves psychiatrists, we call ourselves MDs. We love to hold that up as sort of the talisman of our profession. But in fact, what we do 90% of the time is psychology. We're talking to people, we're not doing physical exams, we're not doing blood tests. We're talking, we're understanding, or we're trying to figure out what makes people tick.
Right. And before we go any further, let's just clearly identify the differences between a psychiatrist and a psychologist.
Right, right. So a psychiatrist, which is what I am, is somebody who goes, takes pre-med courses, organic chemistry, and all those fun things in college. Then they have to take the MCAT, the medical college admission test, you know, get a good enough score on that, go to medical school, which is 4 years. Then they do a grueling 1 year of medical internship, which is, you know, where you stay up, you know, every third night to treat people in the ICU. And then finally, you go to a three-year psychiatric residency, which is really the first time after all that training that you're exposed to what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, which is talking to patients and treating them psychiatrically. Now, psychologists do not go to medical school, but essentially what they do is they kind of go directly to the psychiatric residency part of it, where what they learn immediately is how to understand how to diagnose patients' emotional distress, and they learn all the techniques of psychotherapy very well. And then after that, they practice and do all the practicing that I talked about in order to become proficient at doing the therapy.
All right.
Crucially, they cannot prescribe medication.
Right, and we'll talk about that. And I know you have a call for an overhaul of the way both professions are trained. So we'll cover that, too. We'll take your calls, too, in just a moment. So stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members in Cole Gardens in Concord, helping families start edible gardens with herbs, vegetables, fruit trees, and advice, helping you decorate with living color online at colegardens.com. And Centurion Insurance Group of Hanover, New Hampshire, offering personal, commercial, and wholesale brokerage insurance services to clients nationwide at centurionusa.com. More of The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, how to protect yourself and detect early signs of skin cancer. New Hampshire weather for today, cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs today around 70 in the north, lower 80s in the south. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening. Lows tonight, lower 50s north, around 60 in the south. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, highs upper 70s north and lower 80s in the south. Saturday, cloudy, some showers and thunderstorms. Highs upper 60s north, upper 70s south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Dr. Daniel Carlat. We're talking about his new book, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. In his book, Dr. Carlat says psychiatrists today over-rely on drugs to treat symptoms without getting at the root causes of patients' problems. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Before we go to the phones, Dr. Carlat, just before the break, you were outlining for us the difference between psychiatrists who have a more medical background and can prescribe drugs, psychologists who have a more talk therapy background and cannot prescribe drugs, and yet general practitioners, internal medicine doctors, even nurse practitioners in your regular old doctor's office can give you things like Zoloft and Valium.
This is true, and that probably the majority of listeners who, if they have gotten some of these kinds of drugs, have gotten them from their primary care doctors or nurse practitioners. And so there are a number of other practitioners who do this because there really is a critical shortage of psychiatrists in the United States. I mean, there are about 30,000 practicing psychiatrists in the U.S., which may sound like a lot, but according to the most recent government human resources need figures, we are somewhere in the range of 30 to 40,000 psychiatrists short overall in the U.S. And anybody who's had a hard time finding an appointment to see a psychiatrist can probably attest to the fact that in many parts, I would say particularly in New Hampshire, where there are many rural areas, it may be extremely hard to find a psychiatrist to see.
Yeah, 30,000 actually doesn't sound like a lot in a nation of about 300 million people.
Precisely.
So what's the thinking behind that, that, you know, my nurse practitioner can give me Valium and a psychologist can't?
Well, the thinking is that a nurse practitioner goes to a nursing school background. They do some of what medical students do, only in a very truncated form of that, so that the idea is that since they have some basic medical background, they are more competent to prescribe any kind of medication than a psychologist. And that kind of makes sense in the sense that you probably wouldn't want a psychologist prescribing a blood pressure medication or a seizure medication. But what happens in the real world is that the way to prescribe our psychiatric meds is that we do not do physical exams and we do not do the blood tests or the x-rays in order to make the decisions. We do need to rule out the presence of, say, thyroid disease, for example, as a hidden cause of something like anxiety. But those are things that psychologists are perfectly adequately trained to do in master's and psychopharmacology courses, which they can take, and where they have been able to prescribe now in all branches of the military, in New Mexico and in Louisiana, for almost a decade now.
Let's take some calls, Dr. Carlett. Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Up first is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, doctor. I am a psychiatrist, and first of all, I applaud the basic tenet of what you're saying. I am got into psychiatry from something called the Community Mental Health Center movement, which really has been lost in the shuffle because I liked that notion of being able to treat anyone in the community regardless of whether they could pay or not. And what's one of my theses is that what's changed is the insurance companies have the tail is wagging the dog. The insurance companies want you, or the mental health centers want psychiatrists just to prescribe meds rather than doing psychotherapy, which they want psychologists or social workers to do. My next point is that it was a political decision in many ways for psychiatrists to push medication, to say that they're different than psychologists, and it gives them a guild credit. So, and I am more concerned that everyone is definitely pushing more medication.
Two good points. Thank you, Steve. And on that last point, Dr. Carlett, you talk about that in your book, too. Psychiatrists have sort of created these boundaries to the detriment of patients.
Yeah, and Dr. Nottingham is right about that. I mean, there is a guild that gets set up not only in psychiatry, but in any profession, law, other forms of medicine, where you set up the boundaries of your profession and you create a kind of firewall to prevent others from impinging upon your boundaries. Much of that is obviously related to money, because the more other people get involved in your line of work, the more competition there is. But it's a very complicated argument, because some of the psychiatrists that I have very heated debates with around this issue say that they're not concerned about the money issue, they're concerned about safety issue, and they would argue that there's no way to train a psychologist to prescribe medications in such a way that they could do so safely. And there's certainly room for disagreement here, but I strongly disagree with that point, because I've met and I've seen many psychologists who've taken two-year master's programs who've been able to do just fine prescribing a small handful of basic psychiatric drugs and doing well by their patients.
Well, and in a way, you know, the way you describe that you see patients now, you listen to their issues, you come up with a diagnosis, you prescribe a drug, and if you feel like they need talk therapy, you also give them a referral to a good therapist. So what's wrong with keeping it this way, where you deal with the sort of medical and drug, and the guy down the street deals with the talk therapy?
Well, what's wrong with it is, and the best way to find out what's wrong with it is asking patients who go through the system. So, you know, a typical patient then will see me, and I open actually my book with a story of a woman who sees me for a very bad problem with post-traumatic stress disorder after her father was killed. And I spend an hour, she pours out her soul, she weeps. I give her a medication, and then I give her a referral to a therapist. And she says to me, "Wait a minute, I thought you were going to be my therapist." And it was very disturbing to her. So then what she has to do is see somebody else, and she has to tell her story all over again. That's one problem. The other problem is once she sees that person, I don't have the time, quite frankly, to be collaborating and calling that therapist to make sure that, A, the therapist has even seen Carol, B, that the therapist is doing the kind of specific PTSD therapy that has been shown by research to be the most successful. So the lack of collaboration and communication leads to problems and, frankly, can lead to very dangerous situations, because when two practitioners are treating the same patient for the same illness and they're not talking to one another, you can get into dangerous situations where, for example, one of my patients I found out was taking sleeping pills and was drinking every single night, something that she had not told me because of our very brief infrequent visits, but had told a therapist who hadn't had the time to get back to me about it.
Which would be a deadly combination if not.
Exactly. So it would be nice to have a single, what I call in the book, an integrative practitioner, but you know, whatever you want to call it, a single person who is adept at doing the psychological part of the evaluation and treatment and the basics, anyway, of the psychopharmacology, because it really doesn't take 12 years of medical training to learn how to prescribe Zoloft.
Well, and we talked earlier about TERF and how psychiatrists don't want psychologists to prescribe drugs because that's their TERF. But if you, Dr. Carlett, start doing talk therapy, aren't you taking away from the psychologists?
You know what? There's enough sick patients out there for everyone. That's not going to be a problem.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. To Michelle next, calling in from Nashua. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling because I have been under some form of psychiatric care for about 7 years. And before that, had done some talk therapy and have really found that the meds made my life change. I'm able to be the person that I wanted to be, while having the talk therapy is what helps me dig deeper into the problems. And then feeding off of what I was just listening to, I actually did find a nurse practitioner who is able to prescribe medications. And by being able to see the same person that I talked to for 45 minutes that's prescribing my medications, she's actually been able to hone in on conditions that no one else had been able to.
So which drug are you taking, Michelle, if I could ask?
I've taken a number. At this point, I'm actually now in a spectrum of bipolar drugs. Gabapentin and clonazepam, which those are generics, but...
So it's making you the person you want to be, as you said.
Oh, without a doubt. I have two children. I actually started on the medications during my first pregnancy for concern over postpartum depression, and have gone on and off of medications with doctors' help through the years, and have really identified what they do help and don't help. And it just makes it so that I can be the person I know I'm inside.
What do you think, Dr. Carlett, about Michelle's call?
Michelle, I have a question for you. You said that by seeing the nurse practitioner for both the therapy and the meds, you find you're able to hone in on certain issues that you might not have been able to hone in on otherwise. What do you mean by that?
Well, my initial diagnosis was your generalized anxiety disorder, depression. At one point, I was diagnosed with ADHD. I've had a number of diagnoses, but through talking with her about what was going on in my life and in my past and longer-term cycles is how she came to my current diagnosis, which has gotten us on a path that has really helped me even out my life.
That's very interesting. And, you know, Michelle, I found that true as I've been gradually changing my practice to one in which I'm spending more time with patients over and over again. I find that actually spending more time psychologically and doing more psychotherapy has the added, maybe unpredictable benefit of allowing me to understand how to more accurately prescribe the right kinds of medications for the right syndromes. So it really works both ways. It's I'm just really glad to hear that you found someone that's helping you.
Michelle, thanks for calling.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to add, and actually why I originally called, was to mention that I also, when I do discuss that I am under treatment, there's a lot of backlash about being on medications now because of the problems with, especially when I was doing ADHD medications. And I have a hard time getting people to understand that, while you don't necessarily want to be heavily medicating young children, there is definitely a benefit to those medications.
Okay, and I want to talk to Dr. Carlett about that in a minute. So thank you, Michelle, because you do talk about that in your book, Dr. Carlett. But one more thing for you, Dr. Carlett, please. I'm struck by what she said, you know, the drugs help me be the person I want to be. What do you think about, and don't take this the wrong way, Dr. Carlett, but what do you think about the idea that, you know, we can't handle who we are? We want to be somebody different, just like we might, you know, want to have a different hair color or
less. It's interesting. It reminds me of a New Yorker cartoon where a man is standing at the window talking to his wife and saying, I can't tell, am I a happy man or am I just an asymptomatic man? So, you know, and I often have these kinds of discussions with patients who are on medications. What is it doing for you? Is it something that you need to be on, especially when people are on meds for a year or two or three or four? At a certain point, we get to a point where maybe they're having mild side effects. They're thinking, is this medication really helping me anymore? And it can be very, very hard to know whether the person that you are on medications is who you think you are, or if it's a product of a medication having some sort of mysterious effect on your neurotransmitters. But I certainly agree that, you know, the answer here, and it's certainly what I say in my book, the answer here is not to throw out the medications. The answer is to use the medications and to use the therapy and essentially to use all the best tools that we have for the right patient at the right time.
Well, and Michelle, it sounds like you have found that balance, so I'm glad you called in. You know, she also raised the question that you raise in your book, the concern over use of these drugs like Zoloft or especially Ritalin for kids and teens. And there's even a case in your book, Dr. Carlett, where a 4-year-old girl died because she was given too much of these. So how do we approach use of these drugs toward children?
There's no question that we know that adults have psychiatric disorders and that they benefit from drugs at times. And such adults used to be children, and the children that they were also had psychiatric disorders. And so in some ways it makes sense that they might benefit also from drugs, even at very early ages. The problem is really an extension of the problem that we have in treating adults, which is that we don't understand the biochemistry of the brain. We don't understand how these drugs are working. And in the case of Rebecca Riley, the tragic case of Rebecca Riley, the 4-year-old you brought up who died of an overdose of a medication, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She was prescribed a lot of different medications. As it turned out, it was not the psychiatrist's fault that she died. It was the parents were found guilty of overdosing her and inappropriately giving her the drugs. But the question everybody asks after that case is, how was it that a psychiatric establishment can be so certain of a diagnosis of something as complicated as bipolar disorder in someone who is 2, 3, or 4 years old? And Rebecca, I think, was first diagnosed when she was 2 or 3.
Wow. I mean, a 3-year-old will say anything. I mean, half of it's fantasy, half of it happened last year. I mean, how could you possibly take an answer from a 3-year-old as something that was verifiable?
Yeah, anybody in the audience out there, raise your hands if they have a 3-year-old who's had a tantrum.
I know, or has told a fib.
It's all right. And it happens. One of the disturbing developments in the diagnosis of bipolar disorder is that there has been this idea that having severe temper tantrums can be a diagnostic criteria for bipolar disorder in children. Now, I'm not saying that there are not kids who go beyond the beyond and actually cause damage to themselves or others and need medicating to control their behavior. But the fact is that over the last 10 years, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children has gone up 40-fold, which is 8,000%. And nobody is arguing that there's actually been a biological epidemic of bipolar disorder. something has happened in the way psychiatrists have changed the way they diagnose children to artificially raise up those figures of diagnosis.
Do you think that parents and psychiatrists are using it as an easy way out to
absolutely
solve harder
true.
Behavioral problems?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, when you as a parent are struggling with a kid who's having terrible problems and you have no solution, the apparently biological label of bipolar disorder becomes a very, very seductive label because it leads to an apparent solution, which is the medication. And I'm not the first to say this. There have been editorials written in the American Journal of Psychiatry by eminent psychiatrists who are bemoaning this trend and are saying we are using these labels as a shortcut because we just don't have the time to properly evaluate children. And a proper evaluation of a child takes a lot more than 1 hour. It may take 3, 4, or 5 hours.
Here's an email from Rachel. She says, I agree with Dr. Carlat that psychiatric drugs are overprescribed, but he doesn't seem to have much to say about the damage psychiatric drugs can cause. The scientific data show that these drugs may give short-term relief, but this comes at the cost of drastic long-term worsening of the original problem. Rachel says when patients try to get off drugs, they often experience debilitating withdrawal, which psychiatrists mistake for relapse. This happened to me with the drug Paxil. When I tried to taper off because I wanted to get pregnant, the severe withdrawal I experienced was the worst thing I've ever been through. 2 years later, Rachel says she's still struggling, and her mental state is far worse than it was when she started. What do you think, Dr. Carlat?
There's a controversy there, absolutely. I mean, I would say that there's no controversy that Rachel's kind of experience is real because I have seen patients go through exactly that when they've tried to come off of drugs like Paxil and Effexor, another antidepressant, usually the drugs that are short-acting drugs that come and go in the system, and the shorter-acting drugs cause these withdrawal symptoms. But the larger controversy is whether in the long term we have the data to support the notion that the drugs help in the long term. And all the data that we have from the FDA and the drug companies is typically 6 to 8 week data. And it's clear that the drugs help over that time period. But if we're going to go out 1, 2, or 10 years, we just don't know.
All right. And coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about your prescription for improvement in the psychiatry profession. And we'll take a lot more of your calls. So stay on the line and stay with us.
NHPR's summer raffle has begun. You could win the hybrid car we're raffling off later this summer, but if you get your tickets now, you're entered to win our early bird prize, $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil. Those cards could pay for your gasoline for up to a year, but you need a raffle ticket to win. June 26th is the deadline to get in on the early bird raffle. Call 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from your members and Open New Hampshire, online professional development for New Hampshire educators. Course information at opennh.org. And New London Hospital, committed to healthy living by offering wellness tips online at newlondonhospital.org. Cloudy today, chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs around 70 in the north, lower 80s in the south. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Carlat. He's Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine, Editor-in-Chief of the Carlat Psychiatry Report, and author of the new book that we're talking about this hour called Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. We've been looking at the increasing role that prescriptions play in mental illness at the expense, Dr. Carlat says, of talk therapy. He's calling for a more balanced approach. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Carlat, let's go back to our callers. Roy's been waiting in Webster. Hi, Roy. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hi. I think the doctor has it just right. My wife's a clinical social worker at the Leahy Clinic. What Leahy does, all patients see the psychologist or a social worker for diagnostic purposes. It's interesting because the psychiatrist is really not competent in terms of talking to people and really successfully diagnosing complicated cases. Some of them can, but in general, the training of psychiatrists now is more just to push drugs and not to be really sensitively aware of psychodynamics. So it's at Leahy, I think they do a good job. The people, you know, who get, you know, everyone has to have talk therapy on an ongoing basis in addition to the talk. So you get cognitive behavioral therapy and psychodynamic therapy at the same time that you're taking drugs.
Roy, if I could ask you, your phone's breaking up a little bit, but you said at Leahy, everybody has to do talk therapy in addition to the drugs?
So that's a program that you must see. I don't think everyone, and some people may not continue with talk therapy, but I think almost everyone does. You have to see, you're diagnosed by a talk therapy person, and then you see the psychiatrist who does the medical workup and will prescribe a drug. You know, and some cases, you know, if there's complicated dual diagnostic cases, you know, so it's not just, you know, depression cheeseburger stuff. It's very important. Not only the question is the drug effective, but are you taking the right drug? And if you don't have the right diagnosis, you're often not getting the proper drug for what your condition is.
Okay, Roy, thanks a lot for calling in. Real interesting. What do you think, Dr. Carlat?
Well, I think that has some elements of a good program in the sense that it sounds like the patients are getting a good diagnostic workup from a psychologist. But the problem is that I don't think anybody thinks that the ideal system is a system where you see somebody for your diagnosis and then you get transferred to somebody else to get treated for what that diagnostician has diagnosed. I think what happens in that case is that you have a psychiatrist that doesn't really know the ins and outs of your life and your psychological condition, and therefore is prescribing essentially blindly based on a label that has been provided to them by a psychologist. And I don't think that's the right way to treat patients.
You know, let's get into that a little bit more. Roy, I'm glad you called and raised that. You were saying earlier, Dr. Carlat, that in the long run, we don't know that much about the effectiveness of some of the drugs that we've discussed. But what do we know about talk therapy? What's the hard research that shows that that works?
Well, first of all, there's not nearly as much research in talk therapy, which is mostly because there is no company that stands to profit by selling talk therapy, unlike pharmaceuticals. So we have less research, but we have actually a pretty large body of research. And what we know is that, in general, psychotherapy works better than not having therapy. So when you compare patients who are randomly assigned to the psychotherapy to those assigned to just waiting on a wait list, patients on therapy do better. And then the studies that have compared therapy with medication, which is kind of more to the point, have also shown that that therapy in general works as well as medication for certain disorders, the kind of bread and butter disorders, as I call them, like anxiety disorders and depression. And when you look at the long-term outcome, so you look at the one-year, two-year outcome, the patients who have received therapy and who've learned therapy skills tend to do better because they're able to fend off future episodes of depression.
So except for therapists, you're saying there's no broader monetary gain in our economy toward promoting therapy, and that's why it's not as promoted as drugs?
And that cuts two ways. One is that there's no large companies that have an incentive to do the research to show that therapy is effective. And then on the other hand, the insurance companies provide a financial reimbursement incentive to do more medication prescribing than talk therapy. So it's kind of a double whammy against therapy right now.
Well, Roy, thanks a lot for calling in. And, you know, Dr. Carlat, a couple people have emailed in saying that social workers also provide care. And where do they fit into this equation that we're talking about?
Social workers are probably the most crucial, or almost the most crucial caregivers in the system right now, because they are the major providers of psychotherapy. So when I see a patient and I don't have the time to do the therapy, typically I will refer to a social worker. And just to be clear, in my ideal system, I don't want to get rid of those people who are not going to be prescribing drugs and only going to do therapy. But I do think that we have room for another profession, which is an integrative mental health practitioner who is capable of having the expertise in both the meds and the therapy so that a patient can see one person if they choose to, rather than splitting their treatment among several different treaters.
And are social workers psychologists, or are they in another category?
They're in a slightly different category. They get slightly less training than psychologists, but in terms of the skills of the therapy, since the way you learn therapy is not really by classroom teaching, but it's by experience, there are many social workers who are just as competent in therapy, if not more competent in therapy, than psychologists and psychiatrists. And the argument goes the other way around, of course, because it really has to do with factors that we don't totally understand, but they include personality, natural psychological mindedness, and years of experience doing therapy.
Let's take another call, Dr. Carlett. And this is Jim in Goffstown. Hi, Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good. Go ahead, Jim.
I've always had a problem with the fact that back in the day when I was in school, there was no such thing as ADD and ADHD. Somewhere, I guess, around in the 1980s, it became a diagnosis. And at that point, it almost turned into an epidemic where millions of school children across the United States had this problem, and medication was the answer. I've always been cynical about that, and I'm curious why medication was a quick, is it just a quick answer because people don't have the time or want to put in the effort into the root causes of it?
You know, Jim, this is a great question, and we've actually done whole hours just on this question, Jim, so thank you. Dr. Carlett, go ahead. Let's talk a little bit more about what Jim calls the rise in ADHD diagnoses.
Sure. So ADHD has become what I call the diagnosis du jour lately, and not only in children, Jim, but in adults as well. It's very hard to diagnose because, as in all of psychiatry, don't want to sound like a broken record, but we don't have any objective tests for ADHD. It's all based on a conversation that I have. And one of the big problems is that you can simply look up all the diagnostic criteria for ADHD on the internet. And if you want to come into any psychiatrist's office and get the diagnosis, it's simple as pie. You just remember the criteria, you list them off, psychiatrists will write them down, and then guess what? You'll end up with a prescription for speed, which is not-so-nice term for the medications for ADHD.
Really? You're calling Ritalin speed?
Otherwise known as Ritalin or amphetamine, but essentially these are the bennies, these are the benzodrines, this is essentially speed, the same speed that has caused various waves of addiction over the past century, beginning in the 1920s and 1930s. So anybody does better on speed. You and I would talk faster, would think faster, would feel better on speed. So there's a real problem with diversion where, particularly among college campuses, where kids are getting the prescriptions, whether they have ADHD or not, and then they are selling or giving away their Ritalin and their Adderall to other kids in order to pull all-nighters to study for exams or to do whatever it is they want to do. So that's it's interesting that you've had hour-long programs on this because, indeed, it's a huge issue, and we could spend another hour talking about
right.
The ins and outs and the trials and tribulations of what is ADHD and what to do about the overdiagnosis.
Well, and if you read parenting magazines, the advertising is lovely. You see smiling children, quote-unquote, finally getting their homework done or happily practicing piano. So they're really marketed as a way to create peace and harmony and love in your household.
Absolutely. And, you know, I certainly don't want anybody to interpret this show as saying that ADHD is a myth, because I don't think it's a myth. I've certainly had patients who have serious cases of it and who have responded remarkably well to Ritalin or Adderall. But I've also had other people who've come in who've wanted it, gotten it, and then have had side effects, including psychotic paranoia in one case, one woman that I have seen, which was a direct side effect of taking Adderall when she really didn't need it. And so I had to stop it immediately to prevent her life from falling apart completely.
Let's take another call. And this is Diane in Ware. Hi, Diane. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've always wanted an opportunity to say this to a professional. I used to be married to a person who was diagnosed with depression, and I always say I know five different personalities of Bob, the personality unmedicated and the personality on the four different types of antidepressants that they gave him. All of those antidepressants had significant side effects, and the doctor never conferred with me or the rest of his family. He just listened to my ex, who said, oh, yeah, I feel fine. Yet, again, the adverse effects were really all over the map. One of them made this previously gentle and sweet person an angry and conflictive person. Another one made him, eliminated his sexual drive. And another one made the person who read the Wall Street Journal every day turn into someone who filed for bankruptcy. And yet he felt like his symptoms, his depression was gone. So he felt better on those medications.
Wow.
And he didn't even seem to recognize those personality changes that I was observing.
Wow. And did you try, Diane, to explain this to the doctor? Like, let me give you my observations?
I did call a couple times, but it just really, I felt like the door was closed, and I felt like, my ex was saying that I was, he didn't believe me because he felt so much better.
Wow. Well,
on these meds. And of course, this was a long time ago. This was more than 20 years ago. So, Prozac is one of the ones that I remember. But I just think I reached a point where I felt like it was actually unethical for these medical practitioners to prescribe these drugs without conferring with family members.
Very interesting. Diane, thank you so much for calling in. I'm really struck by this, Dr. Carlett. He felt better on the inside, but according to Diane, was not better on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly happens. But, I think that the saying goes, if all you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. And I think what's happened, and may have been what happened in this case, is that since all psychiatrists really have in their toolbox is a series of medications, they begin to see patients in terms of what medication can I prescribe. And if a patient goes through one antidepressant, they add another one. And if that one doesn't work, they add another one. And sometimes the psychiatrist is not privy to all of the subtle side effects that the wife or the ex-wife can see, partly because we may not be spending enough time with the patient to really ask about side effects beyond just the few sort of throwaway questions. How's your sex life? Are you sleeping enough? Are you motivated enough? And, kind of those questions that take about 5 minutes of your time, and then you write the prescription and set up another appointment.
Well, Diane, thanks a lot for calling in. And, Dr. Carlett, as we wrap up, I did want to ask you how this whole configuration that we've talked about this hour may change given the new healthcare law that we see.
The new healthcare law is going to make things even more problematic, actually, because it's going to bring 30 million or so, more or less, more people into the insurance rolls. And that means 30 million potentially more patients who may be seeking mental health treatment. So if we think we have a mental health crisis in our country now where people are not able to seek the treatment they need, just you wait until 30 million more people come into get insurance and are looking to see psychiatrists and therapists.
Now, I've heard other people say, hey, this is good, though. It's a good first step. At least people will have the ability to seek help.
Well, that's certainly the positive spin. And that's true. I think it's great for people to have coverage in order to seek whatever practitioner they want. But until we get serious about figuring out how we're going to expand the pool of mental health providers, it's going to be tough for all these patients to actually see someone. And in Massachusetts, where I am, which sort of conducted this whole similar health reform experiment already, it's become extremely hard for patients who are now newly insured to find primary care doctors or psychiatrists, or really to find anybody to see, because they're just overbooked and too full.
And one last question for you, Dr. Carlett. This is a pretty pointed, critical book. What's been the reaction among your fellow psychiatrists?
It's gone all over the place. One academic at the American Psychiatric Association yelled at me in front of 20 people.
Wow.
But then the other people come up to me and say that they're very grateful that I pointed out some of these problems that they've already known existed. So, as a psychiatrist, you develop a thick skin. So I'll weather this particular storm.
Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Daniel Carlett, Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine, Editor-in-Chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report, and author of the new book, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producer is Dan Ankeles. Our intern is Emily Johnson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.